Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today on Cable News In Depth, we are speaking with talk show host and author Tom Hartman. Hartman has a new book, The Hidden History of Monopolies: How Big Business Destroyed the American Dream. Let's listen. So I want to dig into your new book, The Hidden History of Monopolies. At the beginning of your book, you draw a comparison between monopolies and cancer. Can you walk me through those parallels?
I think monopolies in the context of capitalism are a lot like cancer in the context of our body. Typically, our bodies are in balance. It's called homeostasis, where, you know, the kidneys do the kidney thing and the liver does the liver thing and the heart does the heart thing and everybody works together. But every day, you know, our body produces mutated cells that could become or even are cancer cells. And our immune system catches them, typically. But occasionally one will get through and you know, sets up house and starts saying, okay, I'm going to take all the resources of this person's body and dedicate all those resources to myself. And so cancer cells start growing like crazy. They build their own vascular systems. They produce their own veins and arteries. I mean, the whole thing, right? They channel all the body's energy to themselves and grow and grow and grow. And in the process, the rest of the body shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, and people shrivel up and die from cancer. Monopolies do the same thing to a capitalist economy. They end up dominating the economy and draining it of resources, converting those resources to their own use and to their own owners. And the result is that the economy becomes poorer, the consumers become poorer, the workers become poorer, everybody becomes poorer. And so we used to have an immune system that dealt with monopoly. I mean, this is something that we came up with back in the 1800s, the Sherman Antitrust Act. And basically it says if an individual company starts to behave like a cancer cell, that's illegal and we're going to break it up or put it out of business. And in 1982 or 83, Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the antitrust laws, the Sherman Law, the Clayton Antitrust Act, the Antitrust Act of 1956. He just said, you know, put all this stuff on hold, and to the Justice Department and SEC and Commerce Department. And they did. And the result of that was this explosion in the 80s of what was called the mergers and acquisition mania, the M&A mania, and M&A artists. These guys called themselves masters of the universe, people like Michael Milken, you know, slamming companies together, laying off workers, you know, making individual departments within companies redundant, and basically stealing all the resources for themselves. And that's where we're at now. We don't have any industrial sectors or any economic sectors left in our economy that are not dominated by either a single monopolistic corporation or by three to five generally corporations that function together as a monopoly. You know, when Delta's prices go up 5 cents, United's go up 5 cents 10 minutes later. This is how what are technically called oligopolies work, but they're cancer.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you bring that up. I think the idea of monopoly, you know, from a consumer perspective can feel really far away. Like, why should I care about who owns that business? But you say in the book that it touches our daily lives all the time. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, the average American family spends an extra roughly $5,000 a year in what I call a monopoly tax, increased prices because of monopolies. For example, in the United States, we've really only got a small handful of internet service provider corporations. In Europe, where competition is the law, monopolies are outlawed in this area, there are literally hundreds of companies in France, in Germany, pick your country, that are competing for your internet connection. And so in the United States, the average person is paying between $50 and $80 a month for internet service that's generally not all that great. In most of these European countries, that same service costs between $20 and $35 a month, and it's much faster and it's more reliable, and it is also not being monitored by giant companies like Comcast, who now that Ajit Pai and Donald Trump did away with net neutrality, can actually monitor every single website you visit, can keep track of every single keystroke you type, and can sell that information to anybody they want or use it however they want. So, you know, monopolies have really done some damage to our country.
Yeah. One of the most interesting parts of the book, I thought, because it surprised me so much, was when you highlighted how one of the perhaps most foundational moments in American history, the Boston Tea Party, had a lot more to do with small businesses revolting against a monopoly rather than the idea of taxation without representation. Can you go into a little bit how the common myth of the Boston Tea Party gets it wrong?
Yeah, no, you got it, Althea. The story we're usually told is those nasty Brits tried to tax the colonies and the colonies revolted with the Boston Tea Party, which is absolutely the opposite of what happened. What happened was in 1770, there was a major worldwide recession, and the East India Company, which was the largest corporation in the world at the time and held monopoly rights to a whole bunch of products in North America, including fine clothing, but most importantly, tea. The East India Company was in a crisis. They were also in a crisis with regard to tea because the American colonists didn't like buying tea from this monopolistic company, and so they were buying it from smugglers who were bringing it in, from other countries. And so the East India Company in 1770 went to the British Parliament and said, you know, we've got an economic wipeout here, and we're in trouble. And at the time, members of Parliament owned most of the stock of the company. And so the way it used to work is that when the East India Company received tea, mostly from India, into their warehouses in the UK, that was when they paid a tax on it. So they had millions of pounds of tea that they had already paid taxes on in inventory. And what the British government did with the Tea Act of 1773 was to give them a rebate on all that tax. They gave all that tax money back. So the East India Company was not only able to sell that tea into the American colonies at a lower price because there was no tax, but because they'd gotten this huge rebate, they could actually subsidize their sales in the United States and cut their price below that of the smugglers. And this was threatening to put lots and lots of small tea shops, which were super popular in the American colonies. I mean, every city block had a tea shop on it. They bars for men in the evening and tea shops for everybody all throughout the day were the centers of communities. And this threatened to put all these small businesses out of business. And that's why they rose up in Boston and went out and destroyed $1 million worth of tea, throwing it into the Boston Harbor and the Tea Party. It was a revolt against a monopolistic corporation using a massive tax cut to wipe out small businesses. It was basically that generation's revolt against this generation's Walmart.
That's wild to think about. That is so different than how it's been characterized. And I think it's interesting because, I mean, as a kid, you're taught, it's like, oh, taxation without representation, that's really bad. It must have been really bad if that's what the lengths that they went to.
Well, it was tax refunds without representation.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It puts that all in a new light. So you, in the book, you track sort of the trajectory of monopolies in America. And at the turn of the 20th century, we did see some serious trust busting, some antitrust legislation after the Industrial Revolution brought about these captains of industry who were able to amass significant wealth and power. I want to know more about those laws and what they were able to accomplish in that time.
In the 1880s, it became obvious that the steel monopoly that was basically owned by Andrew Carnegie, the oil monopoly that was John Rockefeller, the chemical monopoly of DuPont, the explosives monopoly of Dow, the railroad industry of Jay Gould and a couple of his friends, that these monopolies were basically ripping off Americans, that they so dominated industries, the prices were exploding. And perhaps even more concerning to the legislators, giant monopolistic corporations were wiping out small and medium-sized businesses and local state-based businesses. So they passed an immune system for capitalism called the Sherman Antitrust Act. And that act said that, you know, not only any corporation that behaves like a monopoly or a trust is subject to fines and penalties, but the officers can even go to jail. And I mean, it was serious legislation. However, it really wasn't enforced. And in 1901, when McKinley got assassinated, his vice president, Teddy Roosevelt, became president. And in the election in 1904, Teddy Roosevelt, who was a very wealthy New York politician, took a fair amount of money from his wealthy buddies. And so during and after that election, he got a lot of crap from his political opponents, saying that basically he was in the pockets of the big monopolists. And in kind of an emotionalized response to that, he sponsored the Tillman Act of 1907, which made it a felony for any corporation to give money to any candidate for federal office. That stood on the books until it was shot down by the Supreme Court in 1978, and started aggressively enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, going after Standard Oil. The final breakup of Standard Oil happened under the next president, William Howard Taft, who was also a progressive Republican. That's how it started. And basically, we had enforcement of these monopoly laws for the rest of the 20th century until the Reagan era. In fact, it was Richard Nixon who started breaking up AT&T, and that actually increased shareholder value for people who held AT&T stock. They now held stock in 9 different companies. In fact, typically when monopolies get broken up, it's good for shareholders. It's good for the economy, and it certainly opens up space for smaller competitors. But then, like I said earlier, Reagan in 82, 83 just said, we're not going to enforce these laws anymore, and thus we are where we are today.
Right. And you attribute part of that move away from antitrust enforcement to a man named Robert Bork.
Yeah, Robert Bork, most people think of Robert Bork as the guy that Reagan tried to put on the Supreme Court. But his biggest contribution to the history of the United States is that in the 60s, he was a student of Milton Friedman at the Chicago School. And he was really caught by this idea that Friedman promoted, kind of libertarianism, that the federal government should not play that large a role in the economy. And that with regard to monopolies, historically, we viewed corporations as having multiple constituencies. A corporation owed a responsibility to the community in which it operated. A corporation owed a responsibility toward its employees. It owed a responsibility to its own institution, to the corporation itself. Just gratuitously breaking it up and selling it off was unimaginable. That it owed an obligation to its customers, and then finally it owed something to its shareholders. Well, Bork came along and said, that's crazy. That's overly complicated. And this understanding, by the way, is how the antitrust laws were historically enforced. But Bork said, no, you don't want to do it that way. Here, the only thing that matters is whether consumers are paying higher or lower prices. And if prices have gone down, then it being a monopoly, a company being a monopoly, doesn't matter. And his logic got adopted by the Supreme Court in a 1970s case called GTE Sylvania, and then was used by Reagan to stop the enforcement of the antitrust laws in 82, 83. It's been that way ever since. Bork wrote a whole book about this. It's probably his most famous work. And we really need to overturn that Supreme Court decision and go back to breaking up monopolies.
This is for my own knowledge. Does that Supreme Court decision now impair antitrust regulation?
Yeah, okay. It substantially impairs antitrust regulation. There are ways to get around it, but it would require action by Congress.
Right. I think it's really interesting to describe this sort of other philosophy of what the role of a business or a corporation should be, because I think there, at least I've experienced kind of an overwhelming sense of individualism in defending who our current president is. It's like, oh, no, that's fair. They can do that if they want to. Who are you going to tell them that they can't do that? They're going to make their prices lower. Well, they can. So isn't that, if you can, then you should, that kind of mentality.
There's only one force in the world that can constrain a corporation, a giant refinery that wants to pollute your air, or a coal mine that wants to dump waste in the rivers, or a bank that wants to rip you off and charge absurd fees, and that's government. And, the Milton Friedman, Robert Bork, Ronald Reagan folks, and Charles Koch and company, they figured this out, back in the 70s. And this is why Ronald Reagan, in his inaugural speech, said, government is not the solution to our problems. Government itself is the problem. And, of course, it's a lie, number one. But number two, it was the first salvo in taking down and deconstructing our government. Now you've got Steve Bannon saying that, Donald Trump's principal goal as president is to deconstruct the administrative state, which is, fancy political geek speak for destroy America, tear apart our federal government. And that's been the mission of Reaganomics for 40 years. In that regard, Donald Trump is not that exceptional. He's simply saying out loud what Reagan and both Bushes did on the quiet.
So you also highlight in this book, monopolies not, exclusive to big business. You also talk about the existence and persistence of the racial wealth monopoly in the hands of white people, more specifically white men. But it's a monopoly of the middle class. How does that play out and why does it persist?
Well, by and large, the main piece that can be easily identified and about which we could do something is housing. The main way that white families since the 1920s is by the equity in their homes. And that's the kind of equity that can be passed down from generation to generation. And so, you know, after World War II, we had very specific rules and laws that disallowed African Americans from making use of the GI Bill that my father used to buy a house. And that was not available to people of color. And that, you know, the equity in that house was able, you know, when he did die, you know, it got split up among me and my three brothers. And so that up until fairly recently, but both law and banks, you know, with redlining, were just doing their damnedest to prevent black people and Hispanic people in particular from building household equity. And that, you know, if we're going to have a conversation about reparations and making things right, that's one of the first places we should be looking.
So even with all of these problems with monopolies laid out, you propose a few solutions, the center of which is competition. How can the United States move away from these trusts and monopolies?
Well, we're going to have to reinvent Teddy Roosevelt. You know, we need to have strengthened, revived, renewed legislation that brings back antitrust. We need to wake the American public up to the fact that the average family is spending an extra $5,000 a year on a whole variety of products as a result of monopolies, that monopolies aren't just more expensive. They don't just concentrate political power. They don't just exacerbate wealth inequality, but they also make it almost impossible for, you know, young people who want to start their own businesses, entrepreneurs. We need to bring back the local character of America. We need to revive the ability of small businesses to start and succeed. And the only way we're going to do that is by breaking up these giant monopolies.
Attention has been paid to the tech monopolies most recently with Facebook's acquisition of any number of smaller apps.
Yeah, this is one of the principal ways. I mean, Facebook is just doing what John Rockefeller did. Rockefeller would go to his competitors. He was cutting deals with the railroads, much like, you know, Facebook can cut deals with, you know, the ability to pump stuff out on the internet. And he was going to the railroads and saying, you know, I'm your biggest customer. Give me a lower price than everybody else. And then he was going to the smaller refineries in Ohio and Pennsylvania and saying, I'm going to run you out of business. I've got lower shipping costs. But if you join me, if you, you know, I'll give you some stock in Standard Oil, if you'll fold your company into mine and we'll get rich together. And most of these companies took that deal. And that's how Standard Oil ended up basically owning more than 90% of the oil business in Ohio and Pennsylvania, you know, before the regulators came after them. So, you know, that Facebook is just repeating John Rockefeller's old shtick.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to highlight the regulation as part of a healthy competitive ecosystem rather than one that is in some way perverse.
Yeah. In a free market economy, and I'm not using that phrase the way Republicans use it, which they use it as meaning no regulation. I'm using it as where you actually have competition, where entrepreneurship is encouraged, you know, is easier, and where competition, you know, is like a core thing. Competition is the key to the whole thing. And the essential purpose of monopoly is to destroy competition. That, you know, if you were to summarize it in a single sentence, and that's what's happened in America, and that's why we're all paying $5,000 a year more for everything.
What do you hope that readers get out of this book?
I hope that when people read this book, number one, they'll be informed about American history and the turning points in our history that have to do with monopoly and business and the rights of consumers and basically, you know, the health of our economy and our middle class. I'm hoping that they'll be informed, and out of that being informed, will become activists. You know, Ralph Nader wrote a really nice foreword saying it was the most important book written in a generation on this topic. And I'm hoping that he's right and that it will wake people up the way that he was waking people up back in the 70s. It really is high time. We've got to take this on, or it's, you know, these monopolies are just going to totally smother our economy.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up today?
The concentration of economic power that monopoly provides also becomes a simultaneous concentration of political power. And that is poison. I think a lot of the political dysfunction and the anti-small d democratic dysfunction that we see in our society is the result of these giant monopolies getting so large and so powerful that they basically control the regulatory agencies that regulate them. They control members of Congress. You know, pick your industry. You see this over and over and over again. So breaking up monopolies isn't purely an economic process, and it doesn't have a purely economic benefit. It is also one that will restore some sanity to our political systems.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Tom. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Althea. It's great talking with you again.
That was my conversation with talk show host and author Tom Hartman. His new book, The Hidden History of Monopolies, comes out August 25th. It will be launched with Powell's online at powells.com. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.